moved as fast as we could, which was a slow slog, weighed down with a combat pack and bandoliers of ammunition that would probably be too wet to do any good. There were screams and sighs as people were hit, and some were probably short enough to have drowned as soon as they jumped in the water. Sharp pain as a bullet nicked my earlobe. Another mortar round exploded behind me. I didn't look back to see whether it had hit the boat, just tried to lengthen my stride, get to the beach. The water was full of floating corpses, presumably all American. I supposed they had been killed in the earlier waves and floated up, relieved of their ballast, plus the buoyant effect from gases of decomposition. I should have been totally calm, knowing that this was all just a simulation, nobody was really being hurt, but it was too realistic for objectivity. And I couldn't ignore the memory of Alex. If one person could die in a simulation, another could. This morning, the Japanese had written their wills, burned their regimental colors, and saluted one another with a cup of ceremonial wine. It was a good place to die. Not for me, thank you. Of course, the closer you were to the shore, the bigger a target you presented. Men were hunkered down in the water, duck-walking in. One pushed a floating body in front of himself as a shield. So the choice was to scrunch down and be a smaller target for a longer time, or to stand up and move fast. I chose the latter. There was smoke swirling around everywhere, and I figured that if I couldn't see the Japs, they couldn't see me. I did get hit twice more. One bullet hit my helmet obliquely. It felt and sounded like being hit with a baseball bat, but it didn't penetrate the steel. Another bullet took off the tip of my right ring finger. I hadn't felt it, only saw it when I checked the rifle's safety. Then it hurt. The enemy had been preoccupied with two of the Amtraks that had preceded us, off to the left. When the water was down to knee-deep and we could actually see the beach through the smoke, they started to pay more attention to us, machine gun fire doubling and redoubling. Having studied the battle, I knew that the Japanese were taking advantage of a window of opportunity afforded by American bad timing. Air support from Navy planes had come in too early, going by the clock rather than following the actual ground situation, and naval bombardment had stopped early as well. There was so much smoke and dust, the naval gunners weren't sure how close to the beach the Marines were, and Admiral Handsome Harry Hill had called for a ceasefire. Thus, the Japanese were able to redistribute men and ordnance so that they could bring heaviest fire to bear on beachheads, where they could see the Americans were approaching. Something big went off behind me, the concussion driving me face first into the sand. I low-crawled through the surf, butt and shoulders stinging with small shrapnel wounds. On the beach, the dead outnumbered the living. Some were left half-buried in the sand as the tide retreated. A few had been dead long enough for rigor mortis to stiffen them. Most were fresh, blood soaking into the sand. The beachhead was only about 25 feet wide, ending in a revetment of logs about a yard high. Marines were firing and ducking, firing and ducking. While I watched, one man threw down his M1 carbine and ran back toward me to pull a replacement out of the sand, stuck underneath a corpse. I followed him back to the seawall and crouched beside him. "Machine gun nest about 30 yards up there. You got grenades?" "Yeah." I doubted I could throw one that far. Technically, it had a range of 30 meters, and also a radius of destruction of 20 to 30 meters, favoring men with a good throwing arm. I took one off my belt, worked out the cotter pin, then got up out of my crouch, prepared to loft it as hard as I could. After a half second of not being able to locate my target, I just threw it straight out. The target found me, though. A bullet hit the side of my neck with a sharp shock. I went down, clutching it. Oh, shit. The grenade exploded, not too far away. "Here." The other man pulled my first aid kit off the back of my pack and gently pried my hand from my neck. "Not the artery. Not too bad. Hold this." I held the large gauze bandage in place while he tied its strings around my neck twice. Two other men from my Higgins boat ran up and dove down to join us, just getting under a long burst from the machine gun emplacement. "Jesus," one said. "Are we all gonna die here?" Only one out of three, I didn't tell him. most of them, today. The neck wound was so painful I could hardly think, and when I tried to speak, I gagged and coughed blood. It was about enough fun for one day. I reached in my pocket for the black box. It wasn't there. The second of the men who had just joined us rolled over on his side and looked at me. "Looking for something?" he said quietly. He was my exact twin. He reached into his pocket and pulled out the black box. He nodded in the direction of the machine gun nest. "I could throw it out there. What do you think would happen?" "What?" "I don't know. You might actually die." He tossed the black box to me. It felt solid and real. "We have to talk," he said. I looked at the box. Who are you?" When I looked up, he was gone. Two Japanese soldiers leaped over the seawall with bayoneted rifles. One lunged toward me, and I pushed the button. A memory. The war was not even being called a war when Jake's father died. It was a civil disturbance, which in a few days would graduate to civil disturbance being controlled by the military. Then the military would split, and it would become a civil war. His father, a surgeon, had volunteered for emergency room work at Mercy Hospital. There was no record at Mercy of his being an immortal, and he didn't talk about it. Of course, poor people didn't drive Jaguars, and all rich people were suspect. He quit work to go home for the night, but evidently didn't make it past the car door. They later found a small smear of blood on the outside of the driver's window. Jake and his mother stayed glued to the news and never saw the person who left a data cube on their doorstep. It was Jake who found it, unfortunately, while his mother was sleeping. He put it in the tray and watched his father, naked and bleeding, tied to a post, drenched with solvent and set afire. He only screamed once, and then the sound was just flames and laughter. At 10, Jake considered himself a sophisticated consumer of special effects, and he knew the thing was faked, a morbid joke. He was studying it the third or fourth time when his mother came down and fainted dead away. When she came to again, he tried to explain how it couldn't be real. No one would want to do that. She gave him a cardboard box and told him to go upstairs and fill it with clothes, then get another box for winter clothes, take them to the station wagon, and then come help Mother empty out the pantry. Going up the stairs, he heard her breaking the glass on his father's gun case. That's when he started to cry. 13. Doppelgangers. Bruce had also met himself in New Orleans, and his double had also handed him the black box and said, "We have to talk," then jumped off the Canal Street trolley and disappeared in a crowd of revelers. "If he had to talk," I said, "why didn't he just talk then and there?" "I don't know. We were just riding the trolley. We didn't have half the Japanese army trying to kill us. He could have talked all night." We'd called a meeting of the senior VR staff at a picnic table down by the duck pond. The time machine referendum would be after dinner. They'd just finished spin down for Sanitas, a little complicated by having four bedridden patients. But there hadn't been any big problems, and now they were spinning back up to speed, and nothing was being projected on the park screen. There hadn't been any problems with Mentos either. I was still worried about our spin down, partly because I'm a worrier on principle, and partly because of the goddamn ducks. Edison, not as bright as his namesake, was having us chase all the ducks out of the water and cover the pool with plastic to keep the water in place during zero-G. The ducks would just go off in a corner and play canasta until we spun back up again. "It's crazy," Rebecca said, throwing bits of bread to the creatures. "The black box is a real object. How could a VR construct have control of it?" "Just a feedback thing," I said. "The boxes never really left our pockets. We just felt like they had." "Seemed absolutely real," Bruce said. "Never happened before in observer mode." "Me neither," I had to admit. "The machine's learned a new trick." "And it wants to talk to you, or us," Lowell said. Bruce nodded slowly. We're simplifying, as if the doubles were some manifestation of the machine. But there's no such thing as the machine, actually. It's hundreds of different systems. Coordinated by a macro program, though, Rebecca said. Which is not the same as an identity, I said. I'd been working in VR for a couple of hundred years, after all. If any machine had an identity, it was one we put there for our own convenience or amusement, an interface. There was no such thing in the no-frills time machine. What it sounds like to me is a diagnostic, she said. Something's out of order, and this is the machine's way of calling our attention to it. Too anthropomorphic. I mean, we could program it to present diagnostics that way, but we didn't. It's not going to invent some personality on its own. Even as I said that, I knew what her response would be. Why don't we just act as if it had? Go back in and look for your doubles. Not on Tarawa. Once was enough. Wild Year, Bruce said. In Wild Year it does invent, even if it's just random numbers manifesting themselves. Sure, that's always interesting. I pointed behind him. Company coming. I'd left a message for Coordinator Edison Doyle about our meeting, not really expecting him to come since his Friday was totally booked. But he had an interest in virtuality, as well as advanced degrees in artificial intelligence. In fact, he'd brought an AI along with him, the redoubtable Walter Cronkite. Have a seat, Ed. Do you offer a chair to a telepresence? Your machine said you'd be busy. Yeah, I rescheduled. Cronkite here came up with something you ought to know. That was curious. I thought you were updated on Mondays. I am. This isn't new data. It's information I wasn't to reveal to you yet because it's not generally known on Earth. But you should have it. That was more than interesting. A telepresence module taking that initiative. Fire away. He seemed to take a deep breath. People on Earth are dying, too. About half of them in virtual reality situations. I'm not often struck dumb, but it took me a moment to ask, how many? 920 as of my last update. Of those, 410 were in virtual reality, mostly time machines. Why haven't they told us? Rebecca said. I don't know. I suppose to keep it secret on Earth, since you're in contact with friends and relatives. Perhaps they looked on you as a control group, isolated from environmental factors there. Hell of a lot of people, Edison said. Only one out of a million, Bruce pointed out. We've lost one out of 800. I took this initiative, Cronkite said, because I thought the information might be relevant to your planning right now, whether or not to keep the time machine running. I would appreciate it if you didn't let Earth know that I told you. What could they do to you? Edison asked. Unplug you? They could limit my access to information and do it without telling me, or even give me false information. I suspect that would be uncomfortable. Things wouldn't add up, as you say. Redundancy checks would fail. We won't say anything. Thank you, I said, feeling odd. The wise gray head nodded. I don't have much specific information, except that no one in the second generation or younger has died. Only people who were once mortal. Like Alex. Like me. Though technically she was a half century older. Do the oldest die first? I don't know. Very little has been said. The number of deaths is not yet common knowledge. The news of Alex Kaplan's death went out almost 6 days ago. Earth will have it soon. Their response, then, should come in a week or so. You should shut down the machine at least until then, Edison said. The Alex investigation is enough of an excuse. I suppose. People should have all of the information before they decide. You still want to do the Wild Year thing? Bruce asked. Oh, yeah. You don't have to. But if the machine wants to talk, I'd better go listen. What's the Wild Year thing? Edison asked. We explained it to him. I don't know that I'd do it. It's so Alice in Wonderland and Alex in Slumberland, Bruce said. Do we go down the rabbit hole? You don't have to, I repeated. I wish I could go, Cronkite said. A new world of information, and I can't die.